Every second of time, 800 million tons of hydrogen are consumed. The figures are unimaginable, and yet it's still about 96% hydrogen. So it's not doing badly. There's no likelihood of it going wrong for a little while yet. If we then start to move out from the sun, here's a spacecraft which at the moment is prying quite close to the sun, roughly in the orbit of Mercury. It's now dead. It's called the Mariner 10 spacecraft. You can see that it's complete with wings and two little eyes, which was its stereoscopic camera. And this little spacecraft revolutionised our knowledge of the planet Mercury. We knew very little of Mercury before because it always sits very close to the sun, and so we had only the vaguest idea. We had certain dusky markings on it. We were able to speculate certain things. For example, it goes around the sun in 88 days, and it seemed as though the year was the same as the day. In other words, it kept one face to the sun all the time, which meant that Mercury was simultaneously the hottest and the coldest place in the whole solar system. One side never seeing the sun, and the other side seeing it all the time. In fact, we now know that's wrong. And in fact, Mercury goes round the sun in 88 days, but its day is longer than its year. And it resonates, the two resonate, and so in fact, as Mercury goes round the sun, you can, if you're standing on a certain part of Mercury, watch the sun go up and then go down again, and then go up again like this, as the orbit of Mercury catches up on its day. And so all parts of it, it's about 156 days, a Mercury day, where its year is 88, so its day is much longer than its year. This is the orbit, quite a clever little orbit, which the Mariner 10 spacecraft followed. Point A, that's the orbit of the Earth, and here's where Mariner spacecraft came by, and it passed by Venus at point B, then it dived down and passed by Mercury at point C, then it shot up there in a highly elliptical orbit, and by the time it came back to here, Mercury was back again. So that was fine. So we got two lots of photographs of Mercury. And the quality of these photographs are quite astounding, I think. You can see that Mercury is very like the Moon, covered in lots of little craters, and it's baked extremely dry. Close-ups of the surface, you can see it's extremely like the highlands of the Moon, but it appears as though melting has occurred since the impact craters, so that you've got dried up runnels, if you like. But there's been a partial melting of the whole surface here. Sorry about that, it's coming. You can see here a very good photograph of an impact crater, rather like if you're on the sand at the sea and you throw a stone, you get a lovely spattering effect all round as the meteors hit the surface. It's a pretty bleak place. On the surface of Mercury, when the sun's overhead, tin would start to melt and run away in streams. So it's not a very nice place to live. It's about 3,000 miles in diameter. If we then move a bit further out, we come to our sister planet, as it was called, it still is, Venus. Venus, it was never possible by telescope to look at the surface of Venus because it's always covered with thick clouds. That's a photograph taken by Mariner 10 in ultraviolet light. The little square markings you see is because it's a composite photograph. It's made up of many hundreds of photographs all joined together in a sort of jigsaw. And Venus is a very peculiar place indeed. It in fact rotates in the wrong direction and its day is longer than its year. And we knew very little about the surface, and we knew very little about the atmosphere, except that it was mainly carbon dioxide. And the Russians were the first to successfully get probes down to the surface. They did some very brilliant work with Venus with their particular set of spacecraft, but they ran into serious trouble with the first few, which just crash-landed or just stopped signalling. And the reason for this was that we just didn't have a clue what the conditions were. And it's, in fact, the best description you could have, I think, of hell, frankly, Venus. It is a terrible place. The first two space probes that the Russians sent, the parachutes dissolved in the sulfuric acid clouds and hydrofluoric acid clouds as they started to go down towards the surface. Then they were crushed by the tremendous pressure, 100 times ours, we'd be just flattened into a pancake. Then they were nearly melted by the temperature. On the surface, you've got a temperature high enough to melt lead, a pressure 100 times on the Earth's surface, and sulfuric acid vapour and hydrofluoric acid, just to add to the pleasant place. But despite all this, that may not look much, but that is a Venera 9 photograph, one of the Russian spacecraft, photograph of the actual surface of Venus taken under those conditions. That is an astounding scientific achievement. And you can see this is, in fact, by odd coincidence, they landed on the edge of a volcano. There aren't very many on Venus, as we now know, but they just happened to. So again, we started to make false extrapolations. This is a brand new bit of work. This is the map of the surface of Venus done by an American spacecraft by radar plotting. It's been circling the surface and plotting it by radar. The yellow and red areas are the highlands. The greenish areas are the midway level, and the blue areas are lowlands. And Venus has some quite high mountains, and in addition, at least one enormous impact crater. So we now have a pretty good idea of what the surface of Venus is like. And this is all, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years in total. If you want to look up the originals of these, they're in Scientific American about 2 months ago. So if we move a bit further out, we're now slightly more familiar territory. This is the famous photograph taken by one of the Apollo missions of the moon. It's not actually brown, it's just an effect of the angle of the light on the emulsion. And this is part of the near side with the famous Sea of Crises, which forms one of the eyes of the moon. And that then follows with another one, which is Earthrise on the moon. That's taken from 60 miles up in orbit. You can see our own planet just rising over the horizon as the Apollo craft moves round the moon. We're not really a single planet. Our system is a double planet system because the moon is so large that it isn't really fair to describe it, our system, as a planet with satellites. Right, let's just have a look a bit closer at the moon at some of the photographs. Those are two large craters on this side called Reinhold Copernicus. You can see how it looks for all the world like wet clay that's been splattered by somebody throwing stones at it. And basically, as we understand today, this is probably the cause of these. Massive meteorite bombardments have melted the crust, thrown out ejected material. And the moon is a very bleak place indeed. If you weren't there in your spacesuit, if you took your helmet off, you'd boil in a few seconds because of the vacuum, the very, very thin atmosphere. And if you, as the Apollo astronauts had to have tremendous insulation in their shoes too, because, well, you know what it's like walking across a beach and you go into the shadow, how you suddenly, nice cool sand, then very hot sand. Well, here the temperature drops about 300 or 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry, that's an old fashioned, that's not allowed, that unit anymore. Astronomers still use it. This is the Hadley Rill, it's called, on the moon. We think this is probably due to a lava flow under the surface and then a collapse. And in fact, the Apollo 15 spacecraft landed just there. And they then walked across to the Hadley Rill and investigated, picked up samples, and then they climbed up part of this mountain here, Hadley Mountain, towards what's called St. George's Crater there. That's, sorry about the quality of that, it's a bit dim, isn't it? That's the crater Tsiolkovsky, which is on the far side of the moon. It's really a little sea. Mare, if you like, not a sea in the sense we know seas, but an area of relatively low, flat lava plain. These were named by the Russians because they were the first to photograph these objects on the far side. There's one of the Apollo craft in orbit around the moon, and you can see how they've removed the side panel in order to photograph the moon. And the moon, in fact, is very, very well mapped now. Much better mapped than the Earth was, say, 30 or 40 years ago. Of course, the Earth is well mapped now because we have satellites. Are these very dim?
No.
They're okay, they look dim from here. This is taken Apollo 12, if I remember correctly. No, maybe Apollo 14. And you can see here the tracks of the truck which the astronauts were using to drag their samples around and their machinery around on the moon. They didn't call it a truck, they called it a... Oh, I'll tell you after, I can't remember. Everything on the Apollo missions had long, ridiculously long names. I don't know why. Probably to make it sound more scientific. This is Apollo 15. And that's a famous... Well, I can tell you what it was called. Hold on. Give you some idea what they called their truck. The Modularized Equipment Transporter. The MET. Now, this is their car, if you like, which is made with steel wire wheels. And the mud guards aren't just protected from mud, of course, but from moon dust. That's their connection with Earth. And here behind is Hadley Mountain. This is near Hadley Rill. That mountain, on the moon, there's no atmosphere to speak of, so everything looks much smaller and nearer. That, in fact, is 17,000 feet high, that mountain. It looks like a little hump. That's Apollo 16, taking some samples. They drove about 5 or 6 miles away from their spacecraft on that particular mission, and they also took geological samples from very large blocks of rock on the moon's surface. A very nice photograph, which obviously was taken by television because they didn't leave anybody behind, is of takeoff. Sorry. Is that focused? Sorry. Yeah. Of one of the spacecraft taking off from the moon. In fact, when these take off, explosive bolts blow the off the holding latches here, and the little top bit then takes off and leaves the base on the moon. That particular craft, if you put it on the Earth, would just collapse under its own weight. It's designed absolutely for the moon, and only for the moon, because the moon's gravity is only about a sixth of ours. That's a photograph, the best that we could get of the planet Mars from Earth. And you can see here the polar caps, the North Polar Cap and the South Polar Cap, and a dark area called Syrtis Major, which was first seen about 300 years ago, which was believed to be vegetation. And that was the very best we could get. So our picture of Mars was that it was basically a rather desert, low-lying planet. But when the Pioneer Voyager craft started to send back, not Voyager, Mariner craft, started to send back photographs of Mars, even at quite strong distance, like 500,000 miles, we were starting to get some exciting results. Here you see two of the volcanoes on Mars. They're extinct, as far as we know. You can see early morning clouds drifting away from the top of the volcanoes. Here you can see quite a large crater towards one of the poles. But that's 500,000 miles away, so the resolution isn't terribly good. But as you know, we got right close to the surface. Now, this is a photograph of what we thought was an oasis in the desert. It was named Nyx Olympica. It's now been renamed Mount Olympus because it's a vast volcano. The scale of this is hard to imagine, but if we put London there, then Glasgow would be about there. The height of this is about 75,000 feet. Whoops. And it is evidence that, obviously, it's evidence that in the past, Mars was very active volcanically. There's a lot of these quite large volcanoes, although that's the biggest of all. In addition, we found massive canyons on Mars. Looks as though they've been gouged out with giant fingers. This must have been a glancing blow from an enormous meteorite. This particular one, which is the largest, Valles Marineris, named after the Mariner spacecraft. To give some idea of the scale, the Grand Canyon is about the size of that there. They are absolutely vast, although Mars is a smaller planet than Earth. Here we have clear evidence that on Mars, water has flowed in the past, if only transitory. It couldn't have been for long, or the craters themselves would have been much more eroded than they are, particularly craters like these. But there's clear evidence that sometime in the past, there was a great deal of water flowing on Mars, leaving tails like that. Elsewhere on Mars, we see similar tails and dunes in the desert regions. Here's one of the first colour photographs that was sent back of Mars, and it again shows part of that canyon system and other areas of lowland. And you can see how the winds on Mars, which reach very high velocities, 150 miles an hour, in fact one Russian spacecraft was blown over after it had landed, just as it was about to start photographing. You can see how the winds have eroded away the craters to quite a degree. That one is, again, a colour television photograph, and just think of the achievement here. It's not bad to send colour television through about 120 million miles, which is roughly the distance that Mars was when these were photographed. Mars, at its nearest approach to us, is about 40 million miles away, but of course it can be anything up to about 230 million miles away, according to where it is in its orbit. And here, this is early morning mist and frost evaporating as the sun rises in the lowlands, of the Martian lowlands. In addition to this, of course, the most astounding achievement was to land on the surface and photograph it. Here is a photograph of one of the planes taken, P-L-A-I-N-S, taken from near one of the spacecraft. You can see how it's rather like a rocky desert on the Earth, parts of Arabia. If camels had gone by while that was on, we wouldn't have seen them from the nature of the photography, because it scans line by line and it builds up a photograph over a long period of time. So if some Arabs and camels had walked by, they wouldn't have been seen, even if they were there. But all the indications are that there aren't any. Here's another photograph. This is from the other one. And you'll see another remarkable thing. We thought that the sky of Mars would be violet in colour. In fact, it's yellow-orange. So it's a very yellow-orange-red planet. And you can see that the colour of the sky is basically correct from the colouring of parts of the stars and stripes here of the spacecraft, which we used as a criterion. That's a remarkable photograph of the close-up of the surface of Mars. Those rocks are only 2 or 3 inches across. And if you think of sending photographs of rocks 2 or 3 inches across over that distance of space, it's pretty remarkable. Again, you seem to see evidence there that looks for all the world like a dried up riverbed. And we don't honestly understand. But there are suggestions that Mars goes through catastrophic cycles when a lot of water is released from under the crust. And it's in a quiescent period at the moment. That, one of the other interesting things, in mythology, Mars has two attendants. Mars is the god of war, and the two attendants are Phobos and Deimos. And in fact, in the 18th century, I might be wrong here, my history is lousy, Jonathan Swift, writing Gulliver's Travels, spoke of astronomers who'd looked at Mars and discovered two little satellites going around Mars, one of which went round faster than Mars turned on its axis. In 1877, Schiaparelli actually discovered two little satellites going around Mars, and one of them went round faster than Mars turned on its axis. A very strange coincidence. And of course, they've been named Phobos and Deimos. And this is Deimos, the larger of the two, a colour photograph of it, and you can see it's a lump of rock. It's basically a captured asteroid. There are an enormous number of asteroids between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Now let's go much deeper into the solar system. That is a photograph taken by one of the Pioneer craft, I think it was Pioneer 10, of the planet Jupiter. And you can see here, in addition to the planet itself, which is not in full phase, the sun's over here somewhere behind me, you can see one of the satellites of Jupiter. This satellite was discovered by Galileo. It's the satellite Io. And you can see the shadow thrown by Io on the surface of Jupiter. Io is approximately the size of our moon. And we're 4 times the diameter of our moon, so you start to get an idea of the size of Jupiter compared to Earth. That was the best photograph we had from the Pioneer craft of one of the satellites of Jupiter. As you can see, it doesn't tell us a lot, but it told us a heck of a lot more than we knew before. Even that did, because we knew nothing before. At least we could tell from that there was a rough surface and possibly some mountains and craters. That's what the Voyager craft have sent back regarding Ganymede. Ganymede is a little like the moon in texture, except that the plains are frozen water. Water so cold there that it's rock-like. As you probably know, if you go to the Antarctic, when it does snow near to the poles, it's more like a sandstorm than conventional snow because the ice is so cold. Well, it's even colder here. It's extremely cold. And there are craters and rays, signs of enormous impacts. But the most interesting one of all was the Io, the nearest one, which has a rather revolting look about it. I think my wife Pat said it looked like an operation. But when you... This particular one, which was known to be red, that's all we knew about it, is an amazing little satellite and vindicated some theories that have been put forward about the gravitational pull of the satellites in Jupiter, because this is the innermost of the larger satellites, and it was predicted that Io would be active volcanically. In fact, it's a vast ball of sulfur and sulfur dioxide. The red colour is due to sulfur. This is sulfur dioxide snow. And as the television cameras scanned Io, as we passed it, lo and behold, active volcanoes were seen, spewing out sulfur and sulfur dioxide gas. No less than 8 volcanoes were blasting away as the first Voyager craft went by. So that was very exciting vindication of a theory. There's a close-up of an impact crater on Ganymede. You can see the rings that have resulted as the meteor crashed into the surface, which is basically a mixture of frozen ice and ammonia and rocks all mixed together, rather like dirty snow. There's a close-up of part of the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. And here you can see swirling clouds, turbulent clouds working against each other, and a few odd hurricanes, you know, just spinning across the surface. The dark side of Jupiter was absolutely covered as the Voyagers went by with lightning flashes. So it seems rather unpleasant weather there. The moon is about the size of that hurricane. So again, it's on a large scale. And in addition, I'm talking about Jupiter, to everybody's astonishment, we discovered a ring around it. And now we have 3 ring planets in the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus. Uranus was discovered to have rings 3 years ago, and so it's almost certain that Neptune will have rings. Then we're going to be proved wrong again, probably. But at least 3 of the major planets in the solar system have rings. So the old, if you look in an old astronomical textbook, it says Saturn, the unique Saturn's rings. They're not unique at all. They seem to be almost a natural consequence of being a large planet and being able to tear your inner satellites apart, which Jupiter seems to do, and Saturn occasionally. The weather on Jupiter is very interesting. This is a colour-enhanced, computer-enhanced colour photograph of part of the Great Red Spot. The blue are clouds that are higher than the others. And the depth here, I'm just trying to remember what it is. It's about 100 kilometres down, I think, that you get towards the redder area. And this great swirling red spot, which is... been seen ever since the days of Galileo. Nobody knew what it was. It was thought that it might be a floating island on the surface of Jupiter, and all sorts of ideas have been put forward, but it seems to be nothing more than a hurricane. But on Jupiter, hurricanes go on for hundreds of years rather than the few days that we have to worry about, and they're so big that the Great Red Spot, you could drop several Earths into it. There's another photograph of it with an associated white spot hurricane, and you can see the turbulence as the two spinning, as the two vortices interact. And the Earth is about, that size. There's a beautiful photograph which was taken by the Voyager craft of the Great Red Spot, the extremely complex cloud formations, and there's the satellite Io moving in front of Jupiter, and there's the satellite Callisto. And you can see both of those are roughly the size of our moon, to give you some idea of scale. It's an enormous planet with its own little solar system, if you like, of satellites going round it. And it's been very exciting because these 4 satellites represent virtually everything in extremes in the solar system. We've got the most volcanically active planet that we know to date. We've got the smoothest planet that we've ever seen to date because it's like a billiard ball, Callisto. It's beautiful. That's because it's just slightly warm, the water, and it keeps it perfectly round. You can play billiards with it. You've got the most rough and damaged of all, which is Callisto. What did I say that was? Did I say Callisto for that? That's Europa. I'm sorry. That's the satellite Europa. And we've also got one that's like the moon, Ganymede. And it's considered, from looking at the crater impact density, that Callisto is the oldest as surface of the four. Right, I've got one or two others I want to show in a second, but before we go on to that, let's... I'm going to cheat and put one of my slides back in. We're back to our friend the Sun. Now the Sun, in fact, there is a sequence for the stars which describes their temperature and their nature. And this sequence was gradually built up over a long time, and so it's not logical, like most other things. And the letters for it are W-O-B-A-F-G-K-M-R-N-S. W being the hottest and S being the coldest. And everybody remembers that by, wow, oh, be a fine girl, kiss me right now, sweetie. It's the way that astronomers remember this. That's why I can remember it. Well, wow, the W stars are incredibly hot. They're electric blue in colour. And if you put a blue star where the Sun is, the Earth would start to vaporise quite rapidly. So it's just as well we haven't got one of those. Anyway, they don't last very long, and they have nasty tendency to blow up, some of them. We're just a G star. We're way down. We're what's classified as a yellow dwarf. But it's some dwarf, isn't it? When you think that that flame there, that prominence, is 450,000 kilometres high. And when you think that the Sun is losing in mass 4 million tonnes a second to keep us warm, keep a lot of space warm as well, and converting every second 800 million tonnes of helium. Just imagine that. That would, just to keep up with the Sun, imagine we all had a steam engine or something which we had to stoke. And every single member of this planet, woman, child, pensioner, would have to shovel about a quarter of a tonne a second into the furnace to keep the Sun going. Every one of us. And yet it's quite happily going on. Doesn't seem to be over-worried. It's a vast ball of flaming gas, and yet it's quite small and insignificant compared to some. Let me show you by using a bit of a scale model. Suppose we could imagine... Let's make that the Sun. I've done this before, so some of you might have seen this, but just so we can start to... Let's reduce the ball of gas, which is 864,000 miles in diameter, to that, which is about, what, 3/4 of an inch? So there's our Sun. Well, Antares, the biggest planet, the biggest Sun that we know of, which is called a red giant, it's a red giant class, would stretch from here down to Salford Precinct. I'm sorry, I've got my scale wrong there. It would stretch from here to about the Dairy and round. In other words, and that's just its as a sphere. There are other stars, like the neutron stars, for example, that are so minute you wouldn't be able to see them hardly on this scale. And yet they've got the same amount of matter in them as the Sun has. And so the escape velocity, well, the escape velocity from the Earth is 7 miles a second. The escape velocity from a neutron star is something in the region of 18,000 miles a second, about a tenth of the speed of light, in order to get away. There's so much gravity concentrated. But let's look not only at the size of these, but what about the number and the distribution of these in space? Now suppose we say on this scale that the Sun is here. Well, the Earth would be too small to see on this scale, but it would be somewhere where Mr. Costello was standing. In scale. And if we could take the biggest planet of the solar system, which can quite happily swallow 1,000 Earths without any trouble, that's exaggerating its size a bit. A small orange split pea. And I don't know if somebody would like to... Would you like to hold it a second for me? Can you go right back to the gap there? That gap... That's marvellous. Now, we've roughly got the position that Jupiter is with respect to the Sun on this scale. Here's the Sun reduced to this size. There's the planet Jupiter, the biggest, a monstrous planet, 1,000 times the volume of ours. Where would the next star be? Which is a bit smaller than this one. Any ideas? Well, it would be about Birmingham, on this scale. It would be somewhere near Birmingham. That's how empty the space is. The spacecraft that took about 10 years to get to the outer part of our solar system, which has got little pictures inside of men and women and records of Beethoven and the Beatles, in case some alien picks it up. I don't know what they're going to make of it. But there was a great annoyance about this. There's a photograph of... That's all right, thanks very much. There's a photograph of this man and woman in this thing, showing what they were like, and the women's liver projected because the woman was slightly smaller than the man, and somebody else rejected because they were white, and so New Scientist produced a new one where they were identical size and they had clothes on and they were identically striped in black, yellow, brown and white all the way down, so the alien would know exactly what we were like. Well, the nearest star on this scale, as I say, is near Birmingham, and that little craft, which is just passing out of our solar system now after 10 years, would take 80,000 years to get there. And that's the nearest one. Now have a look at our galaxy. Well, first of all, at an object in our galaxy. That's an X-ray photograph of a neutron star. That's only a couple of 10 miles or so across, but it's blazing out so much X-ray energy that we'd be transparent if we were anywhere near. In fact, we'd be dead. The whole of that cloud is the remnant of an explosion of a star somewhat bigger than our Sun. Just imagine what that would be like. But now look at the scale of our galaxy. Every white dot there is a star. Some of them bigger than our Sun, some of them smaller than our Sun, and all of them as distant from each other as the Sun is from its nearest neighbour. But space is so vast that they look all crowded up. And that's a very, very minute part of the sky. That's a massive gas cloud. Just try and count all the stars which you have there. That's what astronomers have to do. They've all been classified and given letters and numbers. In Isaiah it says he knows them all by name. Now then, let's go further out. Take a bigger telescope. And what do we see? More stars and more stars. Some of them smaller, some of them bigger than our Sun. On and on and on. In our galaxy alone, there are 100,000 million stars. That means, suppose we started counting like this, the stars in our galaxy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and on like that. We're not stopping for coffee, not stopping for lunch, not stopping for tea or sleep. It would take 4,000 million years to count the number of stars in our galaxy. But that's only the back door. That's our nearest neighbour. It's called the Andromeda Galaxy. Doesn't look very much, does it? That was discovered by Herschel in the 1780s, who first saw it and called it an island universe. Everybody said he was an idiot. He was right. There's a globular cluster. Hundreds of thousands of stars in it. That galaxy is 2 million light years away. That means that light takes 2 million years to reach there. And that galaxy has 300,000 million stars in it. So, after you'd spent the first 4,000 million years counting the stars in our galaxy, you could then start counting that one. It would take you another 12,000 million years. But the trouble is that there's 1,000 million galaxies. So it's going to take you... 4,000 million... times 1,000 million. It's like 4 million years, not stopping, day or night. Just count the stars in the galaxy, in the universe. And it says in Genesis 1, he made the stars also. Now, if we believe in the God who created the universe, doesn't that tell us something about his magnificence, his immensity, his power? It is unimaginable. If he exists, and I believe with all my heart, I know that he exists. This is nothing to him. He made it all. He made the stars also. It's just an afterthought in Genesis. After all, Genesis is concerned with the earth. Primarily, the whole of the Bible is. But, in passing, yes, he made the stars. And we can start to look back into time. Now, that doesn't look very much, does it? Admittedly. But that object is called a quasar, or a quasi-stellar object. Because we thought they were stars in our own galaxy, but the redshifts indicate such an enormous gravity and such immense distances that they must be way outside our galaxy. Now, this is a controversial matter at the moment. Some recent papers have suggested that some quasars are bunched together and they have different redshifts, which indicate different distances. So the redshift isn't just a matter of distance. But that object, as computed by redshift, and I say everybody would hesitate on that, is 15,000 million light years. So we've got a vast, enormous emptiness filled with these stars, filled with these island universes, which are blasting away from each other at immense speeds. Now, let's just have a look at one or two other things. You know, when David wrote in the Old Testament, some of the Psalms, he must have spent many hours, wasn't he, on the hillside with the shepherds and such like. There wasn't any sodium vapor lamps, there wasn't a curse of astronomers, or microwave ovens, which is, of course, Bernard Lovell, which you probably know for apoplexy. And rightly so, too, it's ruining all the work he's doing, these wretched microwave ovens. But David, that long, long time ago, we read these words in Psalm 8. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And David, when he looked up, could probably see about 2,500 stars. Plus, of course, the Milky Way, which he probably wouldn't have realised, was nothing but millions of stars. And we today can look and grasp and sweep, not grasp it, we can calculate distances and sizes and immensities that are far, far beyond anything which David could have conceived at his time, far beyond what any of the ancients could have understood. And yet here it is. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And straight away the answer comes back. Next verse. Thou hast made him a little less, lower than God, a little lower than the angels, and crowned him with glory and honour. You know, when we look at the universe around us, as Sir James Jean said this at the turn of the century, you can see it on one of those exhibits. You feel that you're just a little speck of meaningless nothing in a hostile, empty, cold universe. And you can search to the depths of the universe. You can go as far as you like with the biggest telescope. But you'll never, never, never discover what that verse says. That God loves us. And that's just, to me, incredible. There's no conflict. You know, science there just makes me wonder more and more at the greatness and the love of God. But let's look at it a bit further, because this is only the beginning. Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. You see, the heavens is an expression of the greatness of God. We read earlier, Paul said, ever since the creation, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. If we want to look at something of what is meant by that, the glory of God, just look at the universe around us. And it's made by him. He made the stars also. It's all part of his universe. Doesn't it seem incredible to you, it does to me, that he should care about us? But he cared so much that he sent his own son, the Lord Jesus Christ, to die for us. But there's more than this. Let's go on a bit and look at other aspects of this subject.